Session number 7304, reel 3.
Colonel King, reel 3. I think you're explaining to me how the layout of the line was actually controlled.
Yes, I think I mentioned to you the fact that my team, there was a major in charge, and he was in charge of the team which controlled the defences around Alexandria, and we worked halfway down the delta, where we linked up with the Cairo team. Now, the Cairo team had a lieutenant colonel in charge, not because it required a lieutenant colonel, but he was in charge, really, of both teams, commander. But he had a person of my rank who did the southern part, up to where it joined up with our left flank, so to speak. Now, the reason for that was that the delta is comparatively easy, because it's like Holland. It's all agricultural. It's very low-lying, and there are hundreds of canals and ditches from the Nile. And, of course, they can't. The only way they irrigate every day or every other day is to open the sluices and irrigate the land. So there's no problem. It's a very, very difficult area for any Panzer division or anything else like that to try and cross. And there was a very large plan emanating and had been for years from BTE in Cairo that if the Germans didn't, or the Italians or anybody got and close to the delta, to flood areas to make it impossible. But as it was possible to foot troops there, and also you wanted to hit any tanks that came to the desert to the edge of the delta, there were defences built, but they were comparatively easy. You had quite high buns there on the side of canals. You could put pillboxes down those. You could super infilading down the canal. You could have your anti-tank weapons. You could have your artillery further behind. So, in actual fact, the layout was fairly easy.
Much wider arcs of fire.
And all you needed, and of course the whole basis was that what armour we had or might have, could operate in the desert, in front, so to speak, of the delta area, and could fall back the canal air there with gaps left there for them to come through and take up positions behind. So, I mean, not such a difficult task. And they really thought that the Italians, anyway, would go the easiest way, and that was along the main road.
The coast road.
Coast road, towards Alexandria.
Can I ask you where you learned to actually design and lay out field works?
I use basic infantry training. And also, the course one did at the tactical school there, the school of infantry, or tactical wing school of infantry there. And what I didn't know how to do, of course, but the sappers provided that information, was the revetting, the communication trenches, the height that you had to have over the tops of anti-tank, anti-tank pillboxes and things like that. But it was my task, and this was the most boring task of the whole lot. I had to say the height and put a post in the ground for every pillbox that was sighted, showing the height of the actual bottom of the aperture of the pillbox. So they could put that was the height of the aperture, and onto that would go your Bren, so you'd get the field of fire that you require. And this was a bore.
Certainly this meant you had to go around crawling on your belly to
you did indeed. On every one. On every pillbox, every section position that was put there. And all the reserve positions you had to do. And you had to do it for the anti-tank guns. I did not do it for the artillery. I had a chap who used to come up from Cairo, the gunner, and he laid out the artillery positions.
Did you actually live on the site, or did you go?
I lived in a pension in Alexandria. I lived in a pension in Alexandria and went out daily to the site.
Must have taken several months to get organised.
I was there from May till December.
So it was sort of 6 months.
I think it was 6 months, roughly. There.
Who actually occupied this defence line once the work had been done?
We had... coming in from Syria, as it was then, the Lebanon, and all over southern Europe, came masses of Poles, who were Polish army people, Polish people who worked abroad, etc., etc. And they all originally formed up in the Lebanon or Syria, and where the French were, under the French control. With the fall of France, they were formed into a thing called the Polish Carpathian Brigade. With the fall of France, they said, to hell with this. We're not going to be Vichyites. We're not going to take orders from Vichy. We want to carry on this war. We're fighting the Germans. So with the fall of France, they moved out into Palestine. Well, they had a complete brigade in Palestine. Now, they were a very, very interesting bunch because, you had engineers as private soldiers in their engineer squadrons. You had very, very bankers. You had goodness knows what. Some of them were rather aged because by my standard then, sort of in their 40s, but still wanting to serve, and they had come from all over Europe. Well, now, this Polish Carpathian Brigade were going to occupy this defensive position, and there was a major snag. They were on, first of all, their weapons were not British, and so their machine guns were slightly higher and lower and had different rates of fire and different fields of fire, they could think. That is the heavy machine guns. The other things were that they were on a... Where the British were on a three sections to a platoon, three platoons to a company, three and so on, like that, they weren't. They were either on fours or twos.
The quadratic system.
Yeah. Now, when you've laid out a battalion position for three companies or anyway for three platoons per company or three sections per platoon, to fit a four in or a two in is rather difficult. And so what happened was they only had two battalions to the regiment, but of course their battalions had four companies, each of four platoons, each of four sections, I think it was, like that. And so they spilled over one, what was we called a company area, into another company area. The snag was they didn't want it that way. They wanted extra positions to be built and dug. And they took a lot of convincing that it just wasn't possible. First of all, from the time point of view, and secondly, the fact was that you cannot put in another section or another platoon into what is a company area there when you have designed that company area for three platoons.
Because your fields of fire already laid out.
Absolutely. I mean, all the pillboxing facing the wrong way and everything else. All you could do was to adjust your company areas. Well, this is done. And for my last six weeks there, spent my time with the Poles trying to fit them in to the organization and the plan that was on the ground. And we had great difficulty. Fortunately, I had a very, very good sapper with me indeed, extremely good chap. He was a person who joined us at the beginning of this project under another more senior sapper as a second lieutenant, and he really, in actual fact, was a civil engineer and civilian architect in Alexandria, and had a business in Alexandria, and had, funnily enough, built some of the best buildings in Alexandria before the war. And he'd been out there many years, speak Arabic, and he was absolutely ideal chap to deal with the local contractors. And eventually he was made a major, and there. And he and I spent our time trying to fit the poles in.
How did you find the poles? Were they easy to get on with?
Terribly nice people, very easy to get on with, but also very stubborn indeed, in some cases. Very, very difficult.
So they're polite but awkward.
That's right. And they would agree to something today, go back and think about it, and come along tomorrow and say, no, we don't like it. But you said you agreed yesterday. Oh, I'm sorry, but we don't like it, really. And this made it very difficult. Kapansky, Colonel Kapansky, was our brigade commander at the time, and he gave us a liaison officer, who was a chap who was a Lieutenant Count Kula, his background was that he was in a Polish bank in Paris. He could speak English, but his French was extremely good. And so a mixture of French and English went on. But we had their head sapper, was a Caucasian, who shaved his head. He looked terribly German, and he couldn't speak French, couldn't speak any English or French. He could only speak German. And terribly nice chap. The only trouble was very difficult to communicate with him. And my sapper, as this major I had, the civil engineer chap, he could speak fluent French, fluent Arabic, and English, of course, but no German. So things were difficult.
You mentioned they had a different sort of machine gun. Can you remember what sort of squad machine gun they actually had?
It was a Hotchkiss.
This,
I remember now, it was a Hotchkiss.
This was
the air-cooled Hotchkiss. And whereas we had the Vickers, water-cooled big thing like that, they had this Hotchkiss. It's a dirty big brute. Air-cooled.
Standard French.
I think it was, yes.
And it fired from a tray rather than...
That's it, that's right. And of course, I hadn't mentioned the fact we had some MMG posts put in this brigade position that I designed there. And of course, you try and put one of those Hotchkiss into one of those positions, it just didn't fit.
The MMG posts would presumably be at company headquarters.
Right. They were. I can't exactly remember, but I think I suppose in that brigade position there was only about a company of medium machine guns, as far as I remember.
Presumably they were given, were they given sort of beaten zones?
Yes, indeed. And they were placed so they, I mean, so you had the full, they had a really good line of, zone of, a beaten zone, line of fire, you know, a perfect one, mainly down the defences. But behind platoons, still firing down your main defensive line, namely your wire and your anti-tank trench.
Speaking of those, did you have mortars as well?
Yes. They were terribly easy. You just have a hole in the ground, as you know. But the only thing was, it was a concreted hole in the ground. The main reason of using all this concrete, really, was the fact that on the northern end, namely the sea end of the line, it was terribly soft sand. I mean, it was absolutely white, soft sand dunes.
So that it would just have drifted into positions otherwise.
They used to grow beautiful figs there, the locals, until we wrecked their ground for them. Beautiful figs.
So the mortar positions, presumably with mortars, you would have firing points laid out on the map.
That's right. Far as I remember, there was a big discussion at one stage whether one should sort of brigade one's mortars. But that didn't thing. So I think we had the whole of the mortar platoon as such all together for each battalion. I think we could so fix it that they could cover the battalion front by doing that, each battalion front, and with a little bit overlap to the left or to the right, as the case may be.
Well, I would imagine they'd be much more flexible.
Much more. Anyway. Oh, yes. Mind you, when you say you dig a hole and put a mortar in there, we also had every one of these, all the way down, you had alternate positions. Alternate positions for your guns, your anti-tank guns, everything else like that. You had alternate positions.
Did the Poles have any other equipment that was really difficult to accommodate besides the...
They didn't bring much, didn't have much with them, but they had some artillery. I know that that was difficult. I can't remember why it was difficult. I suppose the trail of the gun is longer or shorter or something. I don't know. But there was something like that that was different. That was difficult.
Did they have the French 75 then?
That's probably what it was, yes. That's probably what it was.
I think the difficulty there may have been that the trajectory is different. So
that could have been it too.
Whereas 25-pounder is really quite happy in a fairly high angle howitzer roll, the 75 wasn't. Had a flatter.
That's right.
What happened to you when this work on the defence line came to an end?
Well, I said goodbye to the Poles. The sapper major stayed on there to deal with any, what you might call, engineering problems with the Poles there, because they were going to, at one stage, they said they were going to live in it. And people were not very keen for that to happen, because we didn't want the area, there'd be sanitation problems, which were, all right when there's a battle on and so on and so forth. But we didn't want months, it could have been months before anybody attacked the position, so one didn't want the whole place to sort of be have problems such as hygiene. And also, one didn't want the roads, which were metal through this awful sandy country there, which had been just metal with stone put down there, to disintegrate by masses of vehicles going down up and down it.
Routine traffic.
We wanted to see it occupied, so what they did was, the idea was to have it occupied on a skeleton basis, and everybody lived in a tented camp behind, way back. And that's what happened. And the sapper stayed on for about a couple of months more, the sapper major. I disappeared, back to my battalion, who were up in the Western Desert, and this was Wavell's campaign, was by that time on. And I arrived and made LOB, left out of battle, because there wasn't a company at that time for me to go to. And eventually I got up to where the battalion were, which wasn't... I think I met them somewhere west of Merseymatroo by the time they were on their way back. No, they weren't. I can't quite remember where I did join up with them. But anyway, shortly after I arrived, the whole of 4th Indian Division were ordered to Sudan to finish off the Eritrean, finish off to deal with the Eritrean problem. And the CO said to me, well, you're at the moment unattached. You'll take command of the advance party.
How big was the advance party?
Two officers, Then your quartermastering staff, which I think was the RQMS, there was a representative from each company, and a sort of junior representative from each platoon and the VSL, things like that. It was quite big. I suppose the whole lot must be about 20-odd. And we got on a ship at Suez and tooled down to the Port Saddam.
What did you have to do when you arrived at Port Saddam?
Well, now, it was interesting, because at Port Saddam, we arrived there about, I suppose, about 7 days before Christmas. And it was extraordinary. You wouldn't have thought that they reckoned there was a war on, you see, down there. There was a battalion in Port Saddam. No, there wasn't. I'm sorry. There was a battalion headquarters in Port Saddam, a company out of Suakin, and I think the other, and there was another company on garrison duties in Port Saddam, and a company up at Atbara and somewhere else. But the battalions were all spread, but they were only on internal security duties and guard duties and garrison duties. They couldn't accommodate me, or the other officer came with me, and so we put up in the Red Sea Hotel in Port Saddam. Now, they were, as I say, back at peacetime. I was asked whether would I become an honorary member of the Red Sea Club. So I said, well, delighted, thank you very much indeed. And then it was pointed out that I hope I'd come along the following evening, and I asked what the dress was, and they said, I'm very sorry, but it's collar and tie and jacket and things like that. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I don't have a service dress with me. I have a bush jacket, and either wear with a sort of khaki scarf on my neck, or I can put a shirt and tie underneath, but that's it. And I wasn't a very happy thing. I went, and I went in that kit. But there was two back. I don't remember a lot about Port Saddam itself, because I got out as quick as I could, because I agreed that my company, which was going to be B Company, plus another company, were going to be based around Suakin. And there was a company, as I say, of the Worcesters there, I think it was the Worcesters, and they lived in the quarantine station in Suakin. Well, that wasn't big enough for two companies living in. And so, and anyway, I didn't like the area being right down Suakin, and I wanted to be up underneath the Red Sea Hills, under the hills there, so that one could train up in the hills and things like that. And it was agreed that we should have a tented camp there. And so I organized a tented camp for two companies there.
Where did you get the tentage from?
Well, the tentage was there. And the battalion had picked up some, because this was agreed. Because we as a battalion were going to be completely in Port Saddam. There wasn't accommodation in Port Saddam for a complete battalion, because they'd had a company or so out of Port Saddam, I think. And so we got the tentage. So it was B and C companies. I can't remember which the other company was. I was commanding B, a chap by the name of Pollington commanding the other company. And we had some carriers with us, which were forward of us, on the about 5 or 6 miles forward of us, up the track towards Karora, which was actually, Karora was on the border of the Sudan Eritrea. And
so they were a screen then?
Yeah, they were a screen time.
Were they entirely self-contained as a detachment?
No, not really as such. We used to feed us, and what they used to do is, in actual fact, they used to leave out a section there, so section on the track, on either side of the track like that, and the rest were used to come back and go out first light, so to speak, and make a whole complete platoon out there. And, you know, that's the sort of way we moved back.
So you had a sort of night picket, yep, and then a day picket.
Now, the joy of this Suakin tented camp was, the fact that we didn't have to do the guard duties that the parishioners, the rest of the battalion, the garrison duties were doing on Port Sudan, for a start. Second thing was, it gave me absolutely wonderful opportunity to train my company. Sawakin was the old city, as you probably know. And, I mean, it virtually, it was funnily enough, there was not much in Sawakin. It was pretty nearly deserted as a town, as an old city. There were Arabs living, Sudanese living round. But we moved up into the high ground, going up into the foothills, underneath the really high Red Sea hills. And I used to train in those hills by moving up the wadis and things like that. And we had marvellous training areas there. And one thing one company terribly fit. It was a hell of a lot of hill work.
Was the company not fit when they arrived?
Fairly, yes, but they weren't actually as fit as they could have been. And going up into these hills there, and the climate was nice. There was fair amount of vegetation in the wadis. There was a fair amount of game up there. I mean, it's guinea fowl, lots of guinea fowl. And bustard was another thing. So go off for 3 or 4 days up there, it was super.
The usual doctor's prescription of fresh air, exercise,
yeah,
and food.
And troops loved it. And then the other company used to do similar, because we weren't allowed to both be away in case the Italians did attack through Carora along the track towards Sawakin or anything else like that. So we couldn't both be away at the same time.
Did you have much intelligence of what the Italians were doing?
It was terribly difficult to get. Now, the only way we got it was from this wonderful little force created called Meadow Force. And Meadow Force was officered by district commissioners and similarly European people who had been in Sudan and knew Sudan.
Colonial service, were they?
That's right. And we had this tremendous chap who had been a DC at Carora. And they were started in order to be guides, really, for the future. And the soldiery was, in actual fact, mostly policemen, Sudanese police, and similar sort of people, other people, government people. They were absolutely first class. They all had the local knowledge. We could not have done without it. The maps were terrible. They're all on the only maps that were printed on linen,